KSDP, 830 AM in Sandpoint. K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove. KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay. KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass. And KKQA, 88.1 FM in Akutan, Alaska.
You're tuned into KAEB 91.9 FM. All music, all the time.
Hey to all you fish enthusiasts out there. Whether you're an avid angler or just curious about fish, we'd like to welcome you to Fish of the Week, your audio almanac of all the fish. It's Monday, April 7th, 2025, and we're on a week-by-week tour of fish across the country with guests from all walks of life. I'm Katrina Liebeck with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and my co-host is Guy Uro.
And this week, we're going to be tackling the whole genus Amaurus, talking about the seven species of bullheads.
Yeah. And it's just Guy and I for this one. And after we chat bullheads, we're going to catch up on some fan mail darter from listeners who had some requests, some questions, some feedback for us. So with that said, we've got some pretty neat catfish here in the U.S. We've touched on a few other genuses in the Ichthyloridae family, including flatheads in season 3, so that's genus Pylodictus. We cover channel cats in season 2, so genus Ichthyloris, and also hoping to do Yaqui catfish in that genus. And we dug into Smoky Mad Time in season 2 also, which is in the genus Notoris. And I am notoriously bad at speaking Latin, so Guy, how'd I do with all those?
I think you were right on, with the exception, I might say, you said genuses. Well, I think people would let that slide. A lot of folks would say genera.
Ah! All right. So for this genus, what did you say it's called again?
I say Amaurus.
So this one has seven species, right?
So I break it up. So you have the color ones. There's four that are just named after a color. Then there's two that are named after some other feature about them. And then there's the snail bullhead. So I'll start off with just the snail bullhead. That's the one that's the, kind of the outlier as far as names go. The four colored ones, and these include the three most common ones that you're going to see across the country, are black, brown, and yellow. And that doesn't do a great job. It's not like you're going to have one that's really black, one that's really brown, and one that's really yellow. And then the white catfish. Now, some folks will call it the white bullhead. It has been reclassified into genus Amaurus, but for a long time, folks thought it was within Ichthyloris. It has a much deeper fork to the caudal fin, which when we describe these fish, a lot of times folks will just call that the white catfish, but it is actually a bullhead. And then the other two are the flat bullhead and the spotted bullhead.
Okay. And some other names you might hear are like horned pout, mud cat, stinger, river snapper, greaser. Any others?
No, the only one that I've actually ever heard in the wild other than bullhead is the horn pout. And that was from a buddy. He was from Boston, and he was relaying a story. He was in Don Orth's class. Was Don Orth there at Virginia Tech when you were there?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, and so he, coming from Boston, I guess they call them horn pouts up there. There's a whole presentation on the bullheads, and he went up to Don Orth, and I can't really do the accent. He also doesn't have an accent. But he's like, I thought that fish, that's a horn pout, isn't it? And he's like, yeah, actually, you know, horn pouts and bullheads, they're the same thing. So, yeah, that's the only other one I've really heard. You're going to have colloquial, just common names for them wherever you go. So they are widely distributed, so it wouldn't surprise me if you have different common names for them.
Yeah. And to the casual observer, like you mentioned, they all kind of look similar. So how about I do a very general description of bullheads? Does that sound
good? That sounds good. That sounds good.
Okay. So to me, they're kind of cute. They look and feel soft. They have like a kind of fat little tummy. They have an adipose fin like the salmonids. Generally, they don't have a forked tail, with the exception, like you mentioned, of the white bullhead or the white catfish, which it's also called. Their tail fins are a little more squarish, maybe like roundish even. You might notice little spines at the base of their dorsal and pectoral fins. They have nice little barbels, so four on the underside of their bottom jaw, two from each corner of the mouth, and two from the top of the head near the mouth. And I was actually going to draw some on my face, and I forgot. I was going to be at work, but now we're recording this. I'm at home, and I could have drawn it on my face, but I didn't, so I'm kind of sad about that. And finally, and perhaps most importantly, the yellow one has a particularly large buttocks.
That's a good one. That's rich, Katrina. That's related to this paper. Really decent.
And I'm noticing, Guy, your background as well. But
yeah, I'll briefly describe this paper that Christopher Sharpe wrote. Great piece of etymological scholarship, in my opinion. I read it in American Currents a few years back when it was published, but I think he published it independently before that on the Edifish Project site. So, trying to break down, the Latin name for the yellow bullhead is Amiurus natalis. Le Sueur was the person who described that. I think it was like 1819, the early days. Folks, when they describe species today, I don't know if it's actually a requirement of the journals that publish them. I suspect that it probably is, but if it's not, it's at least convention to put a detailed description of why you're naming a fish something, giving a particular Latin name. Back in the day, that was not necessary. And so it was sometimes unclear why certain fish have their names. So later on, David Starr Jordan came out, and he was often hailed as the father of North American ichthyology. He was looking at, and kind of the root word for this, and I'd encourage you to go read the actual article, but basically root for natalis, it could mean two very different things. It could either mean buttocks or it could mean Christmas. And so he's looking at that and he's like, well, okay, I'm going to take the anatomical definition and I'm going to say
makes sense.
It's got kind of a large rump to it, sort of. They are chunky like Katrina described. They're little chubby catfishes. So maybe this one, he thought it had a little junk in the trunk, so to speak. So that got put in a description somewhere. And so this idea that, okay, natalis means having large buttocks is found in all these other resources dating back to that David Starr Jordan description. And so Christopher Sharpe went in, and what he found, what was pretty interesting, is it actually is referring to Christmas. Okay, well, what does that mean? Did he catch it on Christmas? No, he caught it in the middle of the summer. Okay, and so he found this French cognate in something else that Le Sueur wrote called like Pimelode Noël. And now Noël, you know, the first Noël, it's all related back to these like old English and Latin phrase. Natal is like the origin. We're celebrating the origin, the birth of Christ in this instance. But still, it's unclear. But there is this French fisheries inspector, and they have several long names, but one of his names was Noël, N-O-L-E-L, Noël. And so what he was doing was he was naming this as the Christmas catfish after this guy, Noël, who he knew back in France. We don't hear much about Noël today, but apparently at the time, folks would have known him, or at least Le Sueur knew him. And so you had just this weird roundabout way of like Latinizing this one particular name of this French fisheries inspector. Christopher Sharpe makes a really strong case for this being the actual origin of natalis. And so with that story, I made a meme. Katrina, do you want to describe my meme?
Oh, man. Okay.
It's not really a meme because I haven't shared it, but it's in the style of what folks would call a meme.
It's Al Pacino, and his eyes are all wide and his hands are up in the air, kind of like, yeah, they're up in the air. You can imagine it. And it says David Starr
Jordan.
It's a
screen grab from the movie Heat when he's yelling at Hank Azaria.
Great movie, by the way. But yeah, David Starr Jordan explaining the etymology of Amiurus natalis. It's got a great beep.
Yes, it's my finest work.
And he's holding a yellow bullhead. It's amazing.
Anyhow, I think etymology is really interesting. And as I said, I've called out Christopher Sharpe on the show a couple times, and that Edifish Project has is a really great resource. I love it. And that's just a great article he wrote.
Yeah, great job, Christopher.
One thing I do think that is worth noting is the genus name for this one comes from our good buddy Raffinesque. And so you mentioned the tail being, it's either truncate or emarginate, depending on the individual, which so truncate would be kind of flat on the end. Emarginate would have like a slight indentation. It's certainly not forked, sort of between truncate and emarginate. And so the name for the genus is actually in reference to the tail being that way. It kind of translates roughly to not less tail, or as Raffinesque wrote in his thing, tail entire, just to put it in comparison to like the Ictalurus catfishes. So Katrina listed off all the different catfishes that we've talked about on the show before. This one is definitely a smaller one. It gets bigger than the mad toms that we talked about. Those mad toms, most species don't get much larger than a few inches. These guys can get up to like big individuals.
Pounds, right?
a couple pounds. I think world record wise for them are like in the 6, 7, 8 pound range. And now some species, like I think like the spotted bullhead doesn't get much bigger than like 9 inches, but still that's bigger than like a mad tom's going to get, but they don't get the big, you know, 40, 50, 60, 100 pounds like a blue catfish might get. So they are relatively small catfish. There is a little bit of overlap in size between like juvenile flathead catfish, which also have that truncate tail, and bullheads like this. But you should be able to tell the difference between a juvenile flathead and, say, a brown bullhead that would also have that mottled pattern. You look at the shape of the head, it's going to be much flatter on a flathead, and then they're also going to have like a protruding bite that'll be very definite that you won't see in bullheads. I know you mentioned that they do have the adipose fin on the mad toms, if there is any question, which there probably shouldn't be. That's kind of an adipose fin that will fuse with the tail. So this is a free adipose fin.
So it's interesting with all these different catfish. I mean, these guys kind of found different locations, but they've also been moved around, and they're a little bit tricky to maybe differentiate unless you get to know them really well. So maybe we can talk a little bit about general range in terms of their native range, and then just generally they've been introduced kind of widely as well. But let's dig into a little bit of where they're from. These are mostly kind of found either in the center swath of the U.S. or kind of the eastern coast and the southeast. So starting with the brown, native to the eastern U.S., so kind of the Atlantic and Gulf slope drainages, St. Lawrence, Great Lakes, Hudson Bay, and Mississippi River drainages in eastern North America. So all the way from Nova Scotia and New Brunswick to Alabama and south to Louisiana.
Yeah.
The black, they're kind of, again, a big middle swath of the U.S., so that includes like the Great Lakes, Hudson Bay, again, Mississippi River, and drainages on the Gulf Slope, Georgia and Alabama to northern Mexico. Yellow, so that's the Atlantic and Gulf Slope drainages from New York to northern Mexico and St. Lawrence, Great Lakes, and Mississippi Rivers from southern Quebec, west to central North Dakota, and south to the Gulf.
The yellow one kind of has like the biggest native range of all of them. I mean, these are all very widespread, but among the three, it seems like the yellow is kind of...
And those are the most kind of common ones. The white, they're kind of Atlantic and Gulf Coast drainages of North America, ranging from Hudson River in New York to the Apalachicola River in Florida. I say that right?
Yeah. Apalachicola. Is it found in the Apalachicola?
According to the internet. Maybe check me while we're talking.
Yeah, I'll check that. That stands out to me because that's going to be a Gulf drainage river as opposed to an Atlantic slope. I'll check USGS.
Yeah, check me. Okay, and then the snail bullhead. Those are really just found in southeast Atlantic slope drainages. You've got the flat bullhead, more Atlantic Piedmont and coastal plain from the Roanoke River drainage, Virginia to the Altamaha River drainage, Georgia. And then finally the spotted bullhead. So that's in the Gulf coastal plain, like northern Florida, southern Georgia, and southeastern Alabama. And of course, they've been introduced, like we said, elsewhere where they're not native.
I'm looking at USGS distributions right now. It looks like, white catfish all the way to the Apalachicola. So what's interesting, too, is it's all the way down through, like, peninsular Florida. Mm-hmm. I guess that kind of makes sense. They're, of the bullheads, by far the most salt tolerant. I mean, these are generally kind of tolerant species, all kinds of water quality conditions, but when it comes to salinity in particular, those guys are pretty salt tolerant. And so I guess it doesn't surprise me as much that they could maybe go around and get up into the Gulf a little bit. But okay, cool. I
guess I
didn't know that.
Given all that kind of big range and possibility to find these fish, I was curious if you've ever done like the bullhead slam. And if you haven't, you know, thinking about their habitat and where they're found, how would you go about completing the full bullhead slam with all seven species, strategy-wise?
Well, I haven't, but I have thought about it at times. I've caught the common ones, the black, brown, yellow, and then around Athens, where I went to school, snail bullhead is the dominant bullhead. And so I've caught all of those. The ones that I'm missing, so flat, spotted, and I've seen whites down when I've helped out when they're gill netting sturgeon for research. Gill netting for research down like the lower Altamaha, they'll pull up a lot of long-nosed gar, but also a lot of white catfish. In fact, there's one dude I was helping out with his class down there, and he was not paying attention as he should have been and got a spine through his calf from one of these white catfish. It was rough. He had to go to the emergency room. I don't know if he finished the rest of the trip. So yeah, be careful with the spines. They can be serious. So I've seen those and I've handled those, but I haven't caught any, but I also haven't fished hook and line for them. In terms of just finding these guys, I'll talk about snail bullhead, because some of these other species I just kind of run into here and there, snail bullhead I had to kind of think about targeting. And so what I did with that is I knew that they were in the Oconee drainage, which is the main river that runs through Athens. These fish, they all tend to like slower moving water. Some can tolerate faster moving water than others. In fact, the snail bullhead can. We catch them under rocks and stuff in the riffles plenty of times. But finding slower moving water would be good. They're kind of more nocturnal feeders, but that's by no means... There's one time I was working for the Utah DNR, and one of our projects for 2 days was we're going to catch a bunch of bullhead out of pond A and stock them over into pond B that was a new one, basically seeding this new community fishing pond that they were setting up. And so everyone from the office just spent 2 days fishing for bullhead.
Pull
them out of this pond, put them in a big cooler, yeah. And that was in the middle of the day, and I caught like 50. I mean, you can find these things at high densities. And so probably the best thing if you want to fish for them, you know, a worm. I've said this before. I think I've said it on catfish episodes too, you know. You can do the whole stink bait. They're scavengers, and they're generalists, and they'll eat whatever. But I think worms tend to be pretty clean, in my opinion, as far as either live or cut bait or
natural
stink bait
food
types
too.
Go.
I mean, that seems like something they'd like anyways.
Yeah. And so you could fish them if you're fishing in like a community fishing pond type thing, which is, you know, sort of like taking a kid to go fish for bluegill. In fact, some of the earliest fishing memories I have, a lot of them are for bluegill and bass, but they're also for bullheads. And so it can be a good one for fishing just using a bobber. And cause yeah, they'll eat it. They'll take it. They might take it deep. So have hemostats if you are going to release them, or if you're going to keep them, it's probably going to be good to have some hemostats on you. But anyhow, I'm getting distracted here. I like to fish for them on the bottom, like I do with most catfish. Catfish are kind of a bottom cruising species. And so it should go without saying that if you're fishing with a bobber, you want to have it down, not even necessarily touching, like it can be suspended a little bit, or you can just be in sort of fairly shallow water. Like a lot of those community fishing ponds aren't very deep. But you don't want it up near the top. You want it to be down where they're going to find it. If you want to get fancy with it, you know, tie on a barrel swivel, put the line through like a sort of bullet weight type thing or weight that can slide up and down, and then you tie on a barrel swivel and then tie an extra piece of line off of it and then the hook to that so it can kind of move through the weight, or just clip some split shot on there and then get it down there and just kind of keep it tight and wait for the fish to hit. So basically when I wanted to get a snail bullhead, I knew there was this big eddy down below the fish labs. And so I just went down and it looked like good habitat. There's lots of sticks and logs and rocks and places where these fish would probably hide. And you put it down there and you wait. And usually when I'm fishing for bullhead, I don't like to wait too long. Maybe that's just me being impatient, but I'll wait 5 to 10 minutes, and if there's nothing, I'll go somewhere else. Now, that might not be the case if you're fishing for bigger catfish. You might need to wait longer, but for these little guys, if you're fishing where you know that they should be plentiful and you're not getting any action, I'd say move on. Yeah.
Okay. So snail, you've gotten, and you said the major kind of common ones, brown, black, yellow?
Yellow, I know I got yellows down in, there's a stream in Fredericksburg where I was catching a bunch of yellows, and these yellows lived up to their name. They had some bright yellow on them, and they gave me a real tough time with the spines. I'm usually pretty good at handling fish, but I kept messing up. And I tried to look into this. I can't find anything that says that there's any like anticoagulant that they have, because some of these sea catfishes, it's known like, oh yeah, either they have a venom in them, and some of them have an anticoagulant, so you like continue to bleed. Yeah. I was bleeding more than I think I should have when I kept getting stabbed by these yellow bullheads, but yeah, that's just anecdotal.
Did they have a big booty?
Not excessively. So again, I think Sharp was right.
Okay.
Because
good job,
it's
Christopher.
Yeah.
So to get distracted as well, when you're handling one of these, how can you avoid getting spined, or can you, or do you have any tips?
Yeah, and this goes for other catfishes too. You've got like the three big spines, one on each pectoral fin, which is like the arms of the fish, and then one on the dorsal fin. And it's really pretty easy, especially with these guys that don't get too big, to just, now they are slippery and they're scaleless, and you just kind of get your hand behind and sort of latch on, brace those spines open. You just kind of hold on pretty tight. These fish are hardy. You don't want to do unnecessary damage, but they can take a lot of grip and be just fine. Control the fish. Don't let it flop. I think my mistake may have been trying to be too ginger with it and letting them wiggle and then getting me. So
you got to do more Al Pacino. I'll edit that. Okay, so you got yellow, you got snail. What about black and brown?
Black and brown. So all those ones I was catching out in Utah were blacks. I've also caught blacks while fishing for channel catfish in Iowa. I'm kind of dinking and dunking. I remember tossing one in just, this is when I was doing one of Brian Zimmerman's fishing tournaments and trying to just pick up as many species as possible. And so I've been catching lots of channel catfish. I'm like, can I get something else? And I tossed it into like a little root wad. And I pulled out a black bullhead. So I wanted it to be a yellow, and it had yellow on. You see, this is where the things get confusing, because it did have yellow. They all can kind of look somewhat similar. And so I was thinking, like, is this a yellow bull? No, it's black. And knowing what I know now, I probably could have told you that it was a little bit hopeful, but I could probably tell you that it wasn't a yellow. Browns, I've caught plenty of browns here and there. Probably my favorite one, though, when I was fishing for snakeheads out in Maryland, and this was on an artificial on a Panther Martin. I had an issue with line on my reel, and so I kind of just dropped it down in front of my kayak, and I was fixing my reel. This is just like an inline spinner, just a chunk of metal. And then when I started to reel up, I had something on, and it was probably about a 12 or 13 inch brown bullhead, which is big as far as bullheads go. That could be eaten size.
Okay. That's cool. Yeah. And then you haven't caught the other ones?
Haven't caught the other ones. I think I could find the flats without much trouble is what I've heard. And again, the whites, I know roughly where they are. I just haven't really tried to fish for them. Spotteds, I think, would be the tough one.
They're kind of pretty. I like the way they look.
They are pretty. I hear that they're pretty rare, too. And they're down kind of Gulf Plain, like you're describing, like Georgia, Alabama, Florida. I would approach it the same way I would going for any other bullheads, but I think that would be the toughest one.
So if you were to complete the slam, would you just catch the ones you haven't caught, or would you try to do the whole thing and get them all in like 1 year or season?
Well, first priority is just to get them all. I prioritize the life list before trying to do anything within just a single year period. But once they're all caught, then I'd happily try and do them all in a year if I could find the time.
Yeah. Okay. You mentioned Minnesota, and I guess Waterville has been called the bullhead capital of the world and just recently celebrated their 60th Bullhead Days anniversary.
Ooh, what do they do during the Bullhead Days?
Yeah, it sounds really cool, and I haven't been, but it sounds like there's like classic cars and street dance and fireworks and fishing and bingo and tractor pull parade, all kinds of stuff. I guess black bullheads used to be super abundant up there and super popular to fish for. And I was reading some old creel surveys back in the 80s, like half the people fishing were targeting these fish. And I think it was 84 anglers harvested 82,000 pounds of bullheads, which is a ton. And I guess since then, though, conditions have changed, management's changed, preferences have changed, and this isn't a big target anymore as much, but kind of a history for that Minnesota town and this fish.
Yeah. And what's interesting, too, is that up in Minnesota, they had a historic commercial fishery for these fish. And I think 84, I don't know, I think that might be pushing it in terms of when the commercial fisheries existed for them. But yeah, they did have commercial. You mentioned that they've gone down, and that's interesting. Do you have any idea why that might be?
I mean, I know these guys are pretty tolerant of, I guess, poor conditions than a lot of fish, and it sounds like things have improved. So some of the other fish that maybe couldn't do well before that people prefer, like walleyes and some of those other species, which has kind of shifted more into that larger community of fish.
Yeah. And I guess also these fish will eat bullheads, so could be that, okay, it's not that bullheads can't thrive in clean water, that they need poor water to thrive. It's that, okay, when you allow these other things that are the predators, you make the conditions good enough for them to come back, that's going to have a depressive force on the bullhead population. And then, as you mentioned too, I guess, yeah, you have this angler preference. A lot of folks, you know, they'll fish for whatever's biting. If you have other things biting as well, they're going to maybe shift away from bullhead.
And some of those other fish are pretty tasty.
Yeah. What was the name of this town again?
Waterville.
Waterville. I think there were some murders that took place in Waterville. Bullhead murders.
What? Because
there was bullhead bootleggers. Yeah. Have you heard about that?
No, I haven't heard about that.
So, and I don't know the full story. I think there's a book on it. I have not read the book. It's called Tragedy on Fish Row.
Ooh.
It's a true story. And I don't know that anyone really knows what happened because everyone ended up dead. But it was something. Yeah. No, like I said, so bullhead bootleggers. And this is back in 1940, I believe. Basically, the state put a limit on the number. And this is back when people were using like gill nets to catch these fish for consumption for people to eat and everything. So it's not just hook and line. It's not just anglers catching these. It's a full-scale kind of commercial fishery. And so they reduced the limit to like 50 fish per person per day, which is still quite a few. But there's this guy, and he, you know, was still bringing in and processing lots of fish. He was getting them from illegal sources. He had people catching more than their limit or bringing them in across state lines and stuff like that. I don't know all the details, but three game wardens showed up. And what I heard, he said, like, you want to see my license? So he went home and he's going to get his license to show him, I guess, a commercial license because they found it like 1,000 pounds of fish back in the barn or something.
Oh,
and
man.
Instead of bringing his license, he brings a shotgun. And he starts blasting and then kills himself at the end.
Oh, my gosh.
It was like, yeah, no,
bullheads?
It sounds like a wild story over bullheads.
Jeez.
Yeah.
I got to read that book.
So, yeah, I do too.
Interesting and terrible, but yeah, man.
I had an interesting conversation, though, with Tyler Winter. This is kind of related to the Minnesota stuff. So not only did people eat those, they're actually good bait. People like to use them as bait, particularly for flathead catfishes. And one thing that's interesting, so Tyler wrote this in the Environmental Biology of Fishes. Is kind of a recap of rough fish laws in Minnesota, which we know that he's played a big role in. But so I guess technically they are statutory minnows when they're under 7 inches. So a bullhead up there under 7 inches is technically a minnow as far as the law is concerned. Meanwhile, they want to use 10 inchers for bait. And so I guess those aren't minnows. And then there's some interesting laws in Minnesota about based on what size, what legal designation they have. Are they a minnow or are they rough fish? I don't believe that they're considered sport fish up there. So
yeah.
That's
Thanks,
interesting.
Tyler. It's a good source of information for sure. What else? I guess these guys can make little noises. You able to make the noise guy? Have you heard them?
They kind of squeak.
Okay.
And I think it's the stridulations that other ictalurus ones have where they're
like rubbing their bones in their pectoral girdle or whatever.
Yeah, it's like rubbing the spines with the pectoral girdle. And then I guess it probably like resonates through the gas bladder or something. I'm not an expert on fish noise and should not be treated as one.
Do the sound again.
It sounds pitiful when they're out in the air. I'm sure they're just squeaking. We didn't go through the Latin names for the other ones, which none of them are particularly interesting, with the exception of possibly the white bullhead.
So, you know, we've kind of gone into the yellow bullhead, which has the interesting name, but what are the Latin names for the other species?
The rest of them, it's pretty well directly linked with their name and their appearance in some form or fashion. For instance, the flat bullhead is platycephalus. It means flat-headed. Snail bullhead is bruneus, which means brown. So the brown bullhead doesn't have a specific epithet meaning brown. That's the snail bullhead. But again, they're also kind of brown. The brown is actually nebulosus, which means cloudy, referring to the mottling. The black bullhead is malus, like melanin, which means black. We have talked about how, okay, these are notoriously can be very difficult to distinguish from one another, but this ties in with one of these characters that can be used to distinguish them. Ceracanthus is the specific epithet for the spotted bullhead, and that's referring to its pectoral spine that has like a saw. Cera, like serrated, you know, like a serrated blade, and acanthus, meaning spine. The only one else that is kind of interesting is the white catfish, which is Amaurus catus.
Oh, clever.
Yeah. So this was described by Carl Linnaeus in 1758. Systema Naturae, the number 10, which that's the first publication in which any animals were ever described. So, and you know, so it's like tied for first for what was the first animal given a scientific name. But this is one of the ones that is the first animals ever described. And so it got the name catus because it's a catfish. It's got whiskers like a cat. And so that's actually kind of cool, I think. Catus being the Latin for cat, C-A-T-U-S, not C-A-D-D-I-S. But what kind of throws me for a little bit of a loop with that one is there are catfishes over in Europe. He's over in Sweden doing this, so obviously someone must have brought one of these back over. I guess someone who had been living over in the American colonies or collecting specimens. The Wells catfish, those are like those big, you know, they can get like 8 foot, 300 pound eating pigeons, big old catfish that exist over in Europe. He called that one Silurus glanus, which I think is referring to some Latin or possibly Greek names for catfish, but not cats. And so this is referring to like the animal cats. So, yeah.
Cool. Anyhow. That's cool. Are there any other ways that you can kind of physically tell the difference? I mean, I know the whiskers could maybe be a little different color, but do you have any easy way for folks maybe going after that slam where they could be like, okay, I have a black bullhead or I have a yellow bullhead?
Yeah, you kind of hit the nail on the head there talking about how hard it is, because they are all pretty similar and there's great variation among individuals within a species. In some ways, you can have like a brown bullhead that looks more like a black bullhead than it does a different brown bullhead. But there are some characters that you can use to tell the difference. And you touched on one of them is the whiskers. Other people will describe them like, oh, this one's light and this one's dark and this one's dusky and this one's creamy. I can really only classify into light and dark. For the most part, I think all of the top ones on all these fish are going to be dark. And by top ones, I mean the maxillary, the ones coming off of the lip, kind of like a mustache, and the nasal ones coming up off the nose. Whereas the mandibular, the jaw ones coming off the chin, can be light or dark. The snail and the flat, among these other characteristics, are particularly hard, in my opinion, to tell apart. One way that I've heard that you can do it, again, this is another one where they're like, oh, well, on the flat, they're light on the bottom, but on the snail, they're dusky. They look the same to me. You can do, to some degree, anal fin ray counts or looking at the gill rakers as well, but I'm trying to talk about more easily identifiable. Some species will have a dark blotch at the base of the dorsal fin. It's usually pretty apparent, especially on larger individuals, like snail bullhead will have that. That's just kind of a presence absence. And so I think it's like the big three don't, whereas the snail, the flat, the spotted do have dark blotches. The other thing is looking at serrations on the pectoral fin spines. And that's harder to see, but you can
maybe
look.
Maybe as it's like jabbing you, you get a real good look.
Most of them, if they're going to have them, will have like 5 to 8. The spotted, we mentioned the name Saracanthus, it has like, I think, 15 to 20 well-defined spines. But also, that one is easy to tell, too, because it's spotted. And then the other one that doesn't look anything like them is the white catfish. It's more likely to be confused for a channel or a blue catfish than it is another bullhead. And you can distinguish it from a small blue by the fact that it's going to have a rounded anal fin, whereas the blue has a straight anal fin. And that's how you would normally distinguish between like a blue and a channel as well. And also, they don't have spots like most channel cats will have dark spots on a light background. So there are ways, again, those three things, whiskers, blotch, serrations on the pectoral fin spines. It can be hard, especially these very common brown, black, yellows that have been introduced all over the place. And
yeah.
So
can't go off of geography. I guess one tip could be, if you have a camera, try to get shots of those different areas that Guy mentioned so you can look back and maybe look a little more specifically. You want to get into fan mail, Darter?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Well, we got some fan mail, Darter, so we're going to read through those. We actually have quite a lot because the last time we went through fan mail, Darter, so the feedback from folks who listen, I think, was February 10th.
Well, there's one I'll throw out before we start because we just did Alabama Shad a couple weeks ago. The day that that came out, a couple colleagues reached out to me to show me that they had found something on Facebook. One of them was Duncan Elkins. For the first time in 10 years, they found an adult Alabama Shad in the Pascagoula River.
Oh.
So he wasn't the one. He was just sharing the Facebook post. I don't know who the folks on that sampling crew were, but that was this same day that we released the episodes. Obviously, we couldn't
timing.
Add it in, but
there's a few folks that have requested some fish, so I'll get into those real quick. Brian requested that we add cobia, which is the only member in his family, wide migration up the Atlantic seaboard. I put it on our list. I think that's a great suggestion.
One. Yep. It's a good one.
Let's see. Melissa, She actually reached out. We were delayed releasing one of our episodes, and she noticed that. So thanks, Melissa, for noticing that. This podcast is important to her. So we are happy people are following week to week. She did ask that we put Mahi Mahi on the list, which I think is a beautiful fish, and we haven't covered it. Super popular fish. Tasty. What do you think, Guy?
Yeah, that's another good one. You know, with these marine ones, there's a ton that we could do. I agree that that's a really good one. That's kind of the all-around great fish, great fighting, beautiful, great eating fish. Yeah. So, yeah, if we're doing more forays into the marine environment, I think it's a very good one to do at some point.
Yeah. This is a Fish and Wildlife Service podcast, but we are trying to build appreciation for all fish. And, you know, folks are interested in all different types of fish. So we're not just going to cover our listed species or just freshwater fish. So I think that's a really nice addition. Kind of likewise, Chris suggested that we add tongue fishes to the list for season 6. So I put that one on the list. It's a little flatfish.
I like it. They're goofy looking. We've pulled some of those up in trawls in like the Doughboy Sound. The black cheek tongue fish. They're a fun one.
Derpy looking. Lance reached out via LinkedIn and said he appreciates the native fish focus. And we are all about helping all the sweet native fish we have kind of get appreciated. So we're going to continue to focus on that. So thanks, Lance. Amy reached out and said she loves listening to Fish of the Week in her lab, and that it inspired her and another student to do a final modeling project looking at bio-inspired design to fishways. So really love that. If anyone has video of a fish or school fish swimming in eddies, Emmy and her colleague are looking for some footage of that. So you can reach out to me and I can put you guys in touch. Let's see. Andrew gave some kudos for tackling kind of that iterative nature of science in the greenback cutthroat trout episode we did recently. You guys have been requesting different themes, so yeah.
We've had several comments since we initially started asking people for feedback for this fan mail darter, which also, side note, we need a mascot for this, like a little darter with like a Santa pouch or something, that he is the fan mail darter. But a lot of folks have asked for episodes not on particular fish, but kind of on topics about like, okay, well, what is the best approach for defining a species within the world of fish, for instance? I don't want to say necessarily contentious topics, but topics of debate and really these broad things I think would be good. I don't know what the best approach is because we've had some of these episodes like the amphibious fishes most recently, or the mega fishes we did with Zeb Hogan, where it's sort of a departure, but still kind of focusing on the organisms as opposed to these broader concepts within the field of fisheries science or fisheries management or fisheries conservation. I think it would be good to maybe do some of these. What are your thoughts on these kind of more thematic ones?
I mean, I think it's really, this show is for the people listening. So yeah, we're going to try our best to bring your ideas into this. That might mean that we kind of shift the way we do stuff through time. I know, like when we talked about kind of sustainable seafood and the sea robin, we had a fish that fit well for that topic. So we'll probably still be able to tie a species with these topics, but I think we can find ways to integrate these and have conversations through time if folks are interested in them.
All the topics that have been brought up by listeners are good ones to do. I haven't heard a bad idea yet.
Yeah, it's just time. Yeah, time for us, and hopefully we can keep this thing going. So keep the ideas coming. So Mac reached out. He's been listening since our Roanoke log perch episode in spring of 2023. He requested more conversation around species concepts and how that has changed as technology improves. We got a note from Jesper in Denmark. Been listening to the podcast for a couple years, said it's kind of generated a big interest in Micropterus taxonomy as a result. And Jesper was interested in learning more about the intersection of wildfires and fish. So that's kind of neat to hear. And yeah, we appreciate you reaching out. Definitely a timely topic.
I'm glad we got some international fans and
turning
folks on to the true North American fish, the Micropteruses.
We got a note from Jonathan who said, I teach kids about fish and fishing. I used a few episodes in your back catalog to prepare for today's lesson.
Oh, so I think that's, I love really that.
Cool. Yeah, I love that
practical
too.
Practical use of the show. That's fantastic.
Yeah. Okay. So thanks, Jonathan. Let us know if you need anything more for your lessons. when we did our wildlife inspector episode, got a couple of notes about that. So Gary tuned in to that episode. We were looking at the international pleco trade as kind of a follow-on to the armored suckermouth catfishes episode. We are still hoping to do a bit of a mini-series themed around and focused on illegal fish trade and kind of that international wildlife protection piece. Gary had some kind words about this topic being timely and welcome and was interested in hearing more about the Lacey Act and more clarity around not just what constitutes illegal wildlife trade, but also what brings it into legal territory.
Huh. Okay.
We had another listener reach out about the same episode. They wanted to get in contact with our guest to further clarify some of the regulations regarding Brazilian endangered fish and captive breeding. So I think that's super cool and proactive. We do have a general law enforcement email that Dan and other folks monitor. So if you want to send a note there, you can reach out to me and I can help put you in touch with somebody. But I think that's great and we would like to be a resource for folks wanting to do the proper thing when they're importing fish. And that was all I had. What's your shirt say?
This is my public...
This guy's meme just popped up. Public landowner. Nice. All I see is Al Pacino. Oh, and a belt. Oh, that's a cool belt. What does that say? We're having Zoom problems here. I think it says volunteer. Fish and Wildlife
It's kind of got this shield stylized onto a belt buckle. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service volunteer. I know you know that I like coins, but I also like belt buckles. And so I ordered this volunteer belt buckle. It's really cool. And I like it for a couple reasons. Obviously, because it's descriptive. I am a volunteer for the service, both on this show that we do every week, but also going down to the refuges like the Tualatin National Wildlife Refuge and doing plantings or putting trees in the stream to add habitat for coho salmon. So going out and doing this work, I'm proud of this work because I've got this other shirt on and, you know, it says public landowner. And when I get to think, I was like, you know, I love public lands. I'm an American. These are my lands and I'm proud of them. And I hope that more people will be able to take the time to realize this and to get out and use them as well. You know, Ed Abbey talks about the importance, not just of fighting for public lands, but actually getting out and using it and appreciating it in person. I don't think there's anything wrong with how I was thinking about that. But as I started to kind of stew on it a little bit more and think about it a bit more, you know, as any landowner knows, it's not all sunshine and roses. It's not all just going out and hunting and fishing. There's a lot of upkeep that you have to do, whether you own just a condo or a 1,000-acre ranch. You need to put sweat and energy into making sure that it is in a state, it's in a good enough quality that you actually can get out and enjoy it. And so while I initially got this buckle to show off that I'm proud of what I've done with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, for me, it's kind of serve a more important purpose of reminding me that I actually need to continue and to increase the rate at which I go out and put my own sweat equity into these lands that I appreciate so much. And lately, we've seen cuts to budgets across federal agencies, and we've seen staff reduced or charged with taking care of this land. And regardless of how listeners feel about these cuts, I think just as people who appreciate our natural resources and our public lands and our public resources like fish and wildlife, we just all need to start thinking about what we can do personally as individuals to get out there and continue to improve these things for future generations. Ultimately, it falls down to individuals. And so I'm looking forward to continuing to do whatever's in my capacity to conserve fish, conserve public lands. I hope this belt buckle will remind me of that.
Oh, I love that. Thank you for being such a great volunteer, too. You haven't missed one episode. 5 seasons. Except that one.
The one Razorback. I was down in, but I was appreciating my public lands at the time. I was down in the Grand Canyon during that one. So that was long and rambling, and I hope it wasn't overly sentimental, but I do think it's true. I think it's important that we recognize that, you know, we got these great resources that we love to use, but it's not all about using. It's sometimes about giving back and making sure that, you know, if we are public landowners, that also means that we're public land upkeepers to an extent. Yep. Many hands make light work is, totally. You know, a lot of times we're out there and, you know, we end early because so many people have showed up that
just get it done.
You get it done. So
yeah,
I encourage folks to get out there and help.
Yeah, thanks, Guy. That was awesome. We love getting feedback. You can reach out to Guy and I directly or on our Fish and Wildlife social media channels. Again, the show is for you, and we want to continue to make it something you're interested in and tuning into regularly to get inspiration about how to live with, live from, discover, and enjoy all the fish, like the bullheads. So we appreciate you guys.
Appreciate you.
Thanks for listening to Fish of the Week. This podcast is a production of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Alaska Region Office of Communications. Thank you to all who help care for our waters and elevate our understanding and appreciation for all the fish.
You're listening to Statewide News from Alaska Public Media. I'm Ava White. A huge crowd gathered in Anchorage to protest the Trump administration Saturday.
This is what democracy looks like!
They started in Town Square and marched 6 blocks to demonstrate outside Peterson Tower, where Alaska's U.S. senators have offices. Marchers held signs objecting to, among other things, how President Trump is firing federal workers, treating migrants, and demolishing civil rights programs. Librarian Mike Robinson had doubts about the effectiveness of marching and almost didn't show up.
It just seems like the threat is higher than the response of protests. So, but protest is a good way to get people connected, make them not feel like they're alone, see other people, and have voices heard.
The number of marchers was hard to judge, but organizers said more than 1,000 people filled out an online RSVP form, and participants said the crowd seemed much larger than that. The Trump administration has frozen $1 million in funding for Planned Parenthood in Alaska. That's according to Rebecca Gibron, CEO of Alaska's regional Planned Parenthood Alliance. She says programs in 12 states are impacted by the freeze. The funds are through the federal Title X program. It covers family planning and preventative reproductive health care for low-income families, and it cannot be used for abortions. Gibron says if the funds aren't restored, health care for Alaskans will suffer.
We're talking about cancers going undiagnosed. We are talking about people not having access to annual wellness exams. Sexually transmitted infection rates will spike. So this is a program that absolutely must be protected at all costs.
According to reporting from Politico, the administration froze funds for possible civil rights violations. Those relate to diversity, equity, and inclusion, or DEI initiatives, and to taxpayer-subsidized care for undocumented immigrants. Gibron says Planned Parenthood will operate as normal in the state for now. The two centers see about 5,600 patients in person in the state per year, and Gibron says about half their patients use Title X funds. Gibron says Planned Parenthood is examining legal options and will push back.
There are not other providers who will be able to absorb the number of patients with low income who are in need of sexual and reproductive health care. So we are going to fight this every step of the way until these funds get released.
Gibron says Planned Parenthood was notified 2 days before they were supposed to receive the funds that the money wouldn't be available. This is Alaska Public Media.
The Alaska Morning News is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska, offering a one-solution, tailored approach for your financial needs, from banking and loans to investments and more, helping Alaskans shape a brighter tomorrow. More at fmbalaska.com.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering hydrangeas, lilacs, evergreens, and more. Their full collection is at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR.
This is Statewide News from Alaska Public Media. I'm Ava White. The interior community of Delta Junction is getting its ambulance service back. That's after the area's only private ambulance company ended its contract with the city earlier this year, leading to a fight between residents and officials over potential solutions that lasted for months. As Shelby Herbert reports for the Alaska Desk, the city's struggle to retain emergency medical services mirrors what other rural communities are experiencing.
Delta Junction City Council decided last week that it will partner with a nonprofit organization to fund emergency medical services on about 260 miles of interior Alaska roads. Here's City Council member Pete Hallgren.
The city has the money to be able to do it 1 year, but we don't have the money to make it sustainable. That's the problem.
The city used emergency COVID relief funds to pay for ambulance services for the last 2 years, but the city's ambulance contractor, Delta Medical Transport, or DMT, walked away in January when the relief funds dried up. Now that Delta Junction has found a temporary way forward, DMT is back at the table. But the city's funding model is a little bit different this time around. Here's how it works. The next year of service will cost about $1.3 million, and any deductions from a patient's insurer don't count towards that total. But the nonprofit organization Rural Alaska Emergency Services will put up about a tenth of the cost and try to raise even more money from community members. Delta Junction will also try to pay for the service with grants from the state's Department of Health. The worst-case scenario, according to Hallgren, is if the city has to foot the entire bill.
The city of Delta Junction cannot afford a $1 million a year project.
For now, it's good news for Delta Junction, but it highlights the unique challenges to operating EMS services in remote parts of the country. A 2019 National Rural Health Association study points to a multi-pronged problem. Most rural EMS agencies across the country are funded by a hodgepodge of grants, local tax dollars, and community fundraising. Think golf tournaments and bake sales. That patchwork of funding doesn't usually provide a revenue stream that can reliably maintain equipment, software, or people. Most rural EMS services are also highly dependent on volunteers, which can be hard to recruit and retain. Like Delta Junction, there's a cluster of communities in South Central that is also paying for those expensive ambulance runs with the help of a nonprofit. Well, actually, the entire EMS network for the Copper River Basin is a nonprofit. Matthew Lorenz heads Copper River EMS, which also survives off grants and community donations, and they're pretty much all volunteer. But with no municipal support, it can be a stretch.
We know we have to be independent, and so we have to live within our means. There's no tax base or future tax base or anything like that that we can fall back on and say we want to expand our services or we need more money from you.
Loren says they run three aging ambulances over 400 miles of road that are often poorly maintained and icy. And in order to keep people on the fringes of their coverage area safe when help is so far away, they push basic first aid classes. It might not be the perfect answer, but back in Delta Junction, several residents told City Council that they're satisfied with the solution. So far, the city's nonprofit partner has raised almost $5,000 in donations per month. Still, Delta Junction City Council says they're heading into uncharted waters. They say they're treating this agreement as an experiment and hope to find a more permanent solution before the year's end. Reporting in Fairbanks, I'm Shelby Herbert.
This is Alaska Public Media.
When the little bluebird, who has never said a word, starts to sing, spring, spring. When the little bluebell in the bottom of the dell starts to ring, ding, ding. When the little blue clerk in the middle of his work starts a tune to the moon up above, it is nature, that's all, simply telling us to fall in love. And that's why birds do it, bees do it, even educated fleas do it. Let's do it, let's fall in love. In Spain, the best upper sets do it, Lithuanians, and let's do it, let's do it, let's fall in love. The Dutch in old Amsterdam do it, not to mention the Finns. Folks in Siam do it. Think of Siamese twins. Some Argentines without means do it. People say in Boston even beans do it. Let's do it. Let's fall in love. Romantic sponges, they
say, do it. Oysters down in Oyster Bay, do it. Let's do it. Let's fall in love. Cold Cape Cod clams, gainst their wish, do it. Even lazy jellyfish, do it. Let's do it. Let's fall in love. Electric eels, I might add, do it. Though it shocks them, I know. Why ask if shad do it? Waiter, bring me shad roe in shallow shoals. English souls do it. Goldfish in the privacy of bowls do it. Let's do it. Let's fall in love.
Yeah, my opening piece is from the 20s by Cole Porter. And Cole Porter is probably, undoubtedly, has influenced virtually every jazz musician in the last 100 years. Now, to get started here, it's almost out of time for the hour, so we'll have some Albert Collins to take us to the top of the hour. But until then, I have a couple of announcements here. Tomorrow, Tuesday, April 8th at 7 p.m., we have the regular meeting of the City of Sandpoint City Council. So you can tune in on KSDP. And after that, we have on Thursday a meeting at 2 p.m. They normally are at 4. We're having this at 2 p.m., and that's the Allegiance East Borough meeting. And like I said, 2 o'clock. So stay tuned on KSDP for that, too. And now, little Albert Collins.
All my life, yeah. I swear